You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is Lecture 8 of Practical Advice to Teachers by Rudolf Steiner's 14 Lectures. This is Lecture 8 again, given August 29th, 1919. I have already pointed out that where schools fall under external legislation, we must obviously agree to compromise with regard to both religious instruction and the curriculum. But we must keep clearly in mind what is right and best as a basis for the curriculum, so that where stipulations force us to do something unnatural, we can, perhaps discreetly, correct the bad effects. To find the right curriculum for children aged 7 to 14 or 15 is bound up in general with a true knowledge of child development over this period of time. Yesterday we threw light on one moment in this development, the moment that falls between the ages of 9 and 10, when children have concluded their 9th year and are starting out on their 10th. If we follow the development of the child from the age of 7 onward through the ages of 8 and 9, we come to the point where the 10th year is reached that I characterized as the time when ego consciousness is strengthened and consolidated. From then on, we can approach the child with concepts in natural science of the kind suggested yesterday with the cuttlefish, the mouse, the lamb or the horse, and the human being. As you have seen, we must still take account of the interplay between the human being and the environment, and of how the human being is really a synthesis of all the other realms of nature, and must not yet be sharply detached from these other realms. A great deal of harm is done to growing children if we fail in their 10th and 11th years to impress upon them again and again through the feeling life that the human being is linked to external nature and is even a synthesis of the outer world. Another important phase in the child's development comes between the ages of 12 and 13. At this time, the spirit and soul elements in the human being are reinforced and strengthened, that is, those spirit and soul elements that are less dependent on the ego. What we are accustomed in spiritual science to call the astral body permeates the etheric body and unites with it. Of course, the astral body as an independent being is not born until puberty, but it manifests itself in a distinctive way through the etheric body by permeating and invigorating it between the 12th and 13th years. This is another important milestone in a child's development. If we approach them in the right way, children begin to develop an understanding of the impulses that correspond to impulses of spirit and soul, such as those at work in the outer world as the forces of history. I have provided an example of how the activity of these historical forces can be brought within the scope of teaching at the elementary school level. Footnote Discussion 7, Discussions with Teachers. End of footnote. You will have to transpose what I said to you into childlike language. You can be as childlike as you want in your expressions, however, and you will achieve nothing in the way of awakening in the children a proper understanding of historical impulses if you make historical observations in your lessons before they have completed their 12th year. Before that age, you can tell them about history in the form of stories, biographies, for instance. These they would be able to grasp, but they would be unable to grasp historical connections before they complete their 12th year. You will do damage if you fail to observe this turning point. The children will begin to develop a yearning to have explained to them as history what they have earlier taken in as stories. If you have told stories to the children, for instance about a crusader or some other historical figure, you must try to transform the material in a way that allows them to see the historical impulses and links. When you note the changes in the children during this phase of their development, and notice unmistakably that when you develop your lessons properly after their 12th year, the children understand you, it will be possible to say, quote, "Before the children's 9th year, I should limit myself to the artistic element we have discussed. From this I will introduce writing and reading and, later, arithmetic. I shall not make the transition to natural history until after the stage we discussed yesterday. Until they have reached their 12th year, I will not teach history, except in the form of stories." Unquote. At this point, the children begin to take an inner interest in great historical connections. This will be quite important for the future, when it will become more and more distinctly necessary to educate people in an understanding of historical coherence. Up to now, they have never really achieved a proper conception of history. People have first and foremost been members of economic and national life, in which they have participated routinely and unthinkingly. They have coped quite adequately with the requirements and interests of this economic and national life by knowing a few anecdotes about rulers and wars, which is not history, and a few dates of kings and of one or two famous people and battles. Lessons in the future will have to be particularly concerned with the way in which the cultural life of humankind has developed. They will have to include appropriate views on the impulses of history, and these impulses will have to find their proper place in the curriculum so that they are given at the right moment. Something else also begins to become comprehensible to children when they reach the age of 12. However clearly you explain the functioning of the human eye, EYE, to the children before this point, they will be unable to understand it properly. What does it mean to teach children about the functioning of the human eye? It means showing them how beams of light fall into the eye and are taken up and refracted by the lens, how they then pass through the vitreous body and work as a picture on the rear wall, and so on. You have to describe all these processes in terms of physics. You are illustrating a process in physics that takes place in the human being in one of the sense organs. If you want to describe this process, you must first teach the children the concepts that will enable them to take in this kind of description of the eye. This means that you must first teach them the meaning of the refraction of light beams. It is quite simple to do so by showing them a lens, explaining the focus, and demonstrating how light is refracted. But these are facts of physics that have their place outside the human being. We can describe them to children in the period between ages 9 and 12, but we should not apply such descriptions of physics to the organs of the human being before the children have reached the age of 12. Only then do they begin to assess properly how the external world is continued in the human being. Before then, they cannot understand this. They can understand the processes of physics, but they cannot understand how these processes take place within the human being. The comprehension of the historical impulses of humankind and the understanding of nature's laws of physics working in the human organism are akin to each other. The real essence of humanity lives in historical impulses. What is gathered together in these impulses lives in external historical events that, in turn, have their effect on individual human beings. When you describe the human eye, you characterize an activity of external nature that is also working within the human being. Both processes require similar powers of comprehension, and these powers start to develop only in the child's 12th year. For this reason, it will be necessary to arrange the curriculum for children between the ages of 9 and 12 in a way that will include lessons on the simple concepts of physics necessary for an understanding of the human being. In addition to natural history, simple physics will be taught, but the application of the laws of physics to the human being will wait until after age 12. In the same way, stories will be told up to this time and will then be transformed into history. My explanations so far refer to the way subjects are introduced. Of course, we can continue to enlarge on physics after the 12th year. Neither physics nor natural history should be introduced before the children reach age 9. However, and neither history nor lessons involving physiology, that is, descriptions of human functions, should start before the end of the 12th year. If you take into account that comprehension is something that does not simply blossom in the human intellect, but always also includes the feelings and the will, you will not be confused by what I just said. If people do not consider such things, it is simply because they have illusions. You can present the human intellect in a makeshift way with historical or physiological facts before age 12, but by doing so you ruin human nature. Strictly speaking, you make it unsuitable for the whole of life. But between the ages of 9 and 12, you can gradually introduce the concepts of refraction and the formation of images through lenses or other instruments. You could perhaps discuss how an opera glass works. You could also talk with the children about the way in which a clock functions, and explore the differences between a pendulum clock and a pocket watch, and other examples along these lines. Before they reach the age of 12, however, you should not describe to them how refraction and image formation can also be applied to the human eye. All this will provide you with points of reference from which you can learn how the material to be taught should be distributed in the curriculum so that the capacities of the children are developed in the right way. There is more to be observed from this point of view. To a certain extent, it is important that we should not move too far away from life in our lessons, though we should not take excessive account of the trivialities of life either. One might have the following conversation with a child. You might ask, quote, "What have you got on your feet?" unquote, and you would expect the reply, quote, "A pair of boots." Unquote. You would then ask, quote, "What are the boots for?" unquote. The child would respond, quote, "For me to put on." Unquote. Some teachers might think of this as an object lesson, but it is nothing but a triviality. The object lessons occasionally described in books on education are very boring to children at a subconscious level, and as a result cause much damage in them. Remaining too close to life in this way and constantly bringing things to awareness that could very well remain in the unconscious, raising activities that are merely habitual too much into consciousness, is something we should not allow ourselves. On the other hand, we need not lose all contact with life and teach the children empty abstractions too early. This is especially important for physics lessons. In any case, physics will offer opportunities for interweaving matters that are close to life with those that are initially rather removed from ordinary life. You should therefore make sure to develop the concepts of physics from life itself. As much as your inventiveness will allow, you should give the children real experiences. For instance, after having lit the stove in the classroom, you would show how the floor remains cold even after the air is warm. In this way, you point out a fact of life. Beginning with that fact, you can go on to explain how the air naturally becomes warm. First, near the stove rather than near the ceiling, but then the warm air always rises, making the cold air fall. You must describe the process in the following way. The air first becomes warm below the stove, and then rises to the ceiling, making the cold air fall. This is why a room remains cold near the floor, even when the air near the ceiling has been warm for some time. In this way, you have started from a fact of life, and from there you seek the transition to the fact that warm air expands and cold air contracts. This statement takes you farther away from life. Another example would be a discussion of the lever in physics. It is not wise to present just the abstract lever. Start with a pair of scales and move on from there to the lever. Start with an object that is used in everyday life and proceed to whatever can be extrapolated from it in physics. I must point out to you that a considerable amount of what is included in our concepts of physics wreaks havoc in the child, and that a great deal depends on the teacher's knowing what is right and trying to be mature in judgment. You cannot avoid saying to the bigger children, quote, "Here you have an electrical generator. What I have here is a frictional electrical generator. I can make electricity by rubbing certain objects together, but I must first wipe the objects carefully because they have to be very dry. If they are wet, the experiment will not work, and no electricity will be made." Unquote. Then you can enlarge on the reasons why electricity cannot be produced with wet instruments, and you can go on to explain how lightning occurs, pointing out that it is also an electrical process. There are many people who claim that clouds rub against each other and that the resulting friction causes lightning as an electrical discharge. The children will perhaps believe this because the teacher actually believes it, but in their subconscious a special process takes place of which they are unaware. The children say to themselves, quote, "My teacher wipes the instruments before rubbing them together to make electricity, just to make sure that they are not wet, and then tells me that if clouds rub together, electricity is made, but clouds are wet." Unquote. Children notice such inconsistencies, and much of the disharmony in life stems from the fact that children are told such contradictions. These contradictions ought to arise outside in the world. They have no place in our thinking. Because human knowledge and perception are too shallow today, such contradictions, which really tear apart the human unconscious, continually crop up in what we tell children, and later, young people. We must take care that what we bring consciously to the children does not contain too much of what in their subconscious they will imagine differently. It will not be our task as teachers to eliminate from science such nonsense as is maintained concerning the link between lightning and electricity in physics. When we deal with more obvious matters, however, we should always remind ourselves that we influence not only the children's conscious being, but also their subconscious being. How do we take the subconscious into consideration? As teachers, we must do this by trying not to adjust matters to make them understandable for children. I have mentioned elsewhere what this involves. You must develop in yourselves capacities that allow you, at the moment you enter upon a subject with the children, to become as absorbed by the subject as the child is by the lesson, regardless of the subject you are treating. You should not allow yourself to be filled with the thought that you know a great deal more, but that you are arranging it to suit the children. You should not allow yourself to believe that you are quite superior to the children and prepare everything you want to say to them so that it will be suitable for them. No, you must have the ability to transform yourself in such a way that the children literally wake up through your lesson and that you yourself become a child with the children, but not in a childish way. People caring for children often err in this respect, talking baby language with their charges. If the child says dada, they also say dada instead of father. It is not a matter of becoming childish with the children in a superficial way. We must transform what is more mature into something childlike. To be capable of doing this in the right way, we have to look rather more deeply into the nature of the human being. We have to take seriously the fact that precisely with regard to their most important spiritual characteristic, human beings become productive by retaining the childlike element all their lives. We are poets and artists. If we can always relive in ourselves the activity of the child with our more mature nature. To be forever a steady person, unable any longer to use in an inner childlike way our thinking, feeling, and willing, which have absorbed more mature concepts now that we are older than 30, is not a suitable mood of life for a teacher. The proper mood of life for teachers is always to be able to return to childhood with everything they experience and with everything they learn. They will not return to childhood by describing in baby language something new they have learned. They will return because with every new fact they will experience as much delight and intense joy as the children do when they perceive something new. In a word, it is the soul and spirit that should return to childhood, not the external physical manifestation. Then, too, a great deal will depend on the atmosphere that is created between the teacher and the students. It is right, for instance, if you speak about life and about nature in such a way that you take as much pleasure in it as the children themselves do, and are as much amazed as the children. Let me give you an example. You have all learned from physics, and thus know a fair amount of what is called Morse telegraphy. You know what happens when a telegram is sent from one place to another. You understand how the telegram operator uses the different devices, pressing the Morse key for a short time or for longer, thus closing the circuit for shorter or longer moments, whereas the circuit is interrupted when the operator does not press the key. You know that the actual Morse telegraph apparatus is linked to the circuit by an iron lever, attracted by a coil that contains an electromagnet, and that the so-called relay is connected into this current. You know that with the help of a wire, one such apparatus at one station is linked with another at another station, so that what is produced at the first station is reproduced at the second. By connecting the current for shorter or longer moments, I cause a signal to be received at the next station that, when it is transposed, can be read by the operator there. The shorter or longer bursts of current become visible as impressions on a strip of paper, as dots or dashes. The strip of paper runs through rollers. You see, for instance, a dot, and then after an interruption, three dots, and so on. The alphabet consists of dots and dashes. The letter A is represented by a dot, followed by a dash. B is dash, dot, dot. T is just a dash, and so on. In this way, you can read what is transmitted from one station to the next. Yet, everything that is said about this telegraphy apparatus is really only a question of intellectual consideration. You certainly do not require many soul forces to make comprehensible all the mechanical processes that take place when the mechanism is permeated by electricity, which itself can so far be explained only hypothetically by science. But one thing does remain a miracle. Such things really can be described as miracles. And I must say, when I think of the link that is created between the Morse apparatus at one station and that at another station, it never fails to fill me with wonder when I realize how the circuit is closed. the electrical circuit is not closed by means of a wire running from one station to the next, and another wire running back again. This would also be possible, and breaking the closed circuit would then effect the interruption. But this closed circuit containing the Morse apparatus is not created by wires that run back and forth. Only one part of the current runs along a wire. At each station, the wire ends in a metal plate on the ground, so that the earth itself provides the link that could be made through a wire. The earth itself does what the other half of the wire would otherwise accomplish. Whenever you think of how a Morse apparatus at one station is linked to another at another station, you are reminded of the miracle that makes the whole earth into a mediator, taking the electric current as though into its care and duly delivering it at the next station. The earth itself mediates in this way. All the explanations that exist for this process are hypothetical, but the important point about our human attitude toward it is that we should be able ever and again to feel the miraculous nature of this fact, that we should not become blunted in our ability to grasp the processes of physics with our feelings. Then, when we explain these things to the children, we shall find the mood that allows us to recapture the way we first grasped such facts. When we explain a phenomenon of physics to a child who is full of wonder, we shall ourselves become children, full of wonder. Such marvels are hidden in all phenomena, including the process of physics, that take place in the world. Imagine for a moment that you are giving the following lesson. Over there is a bench, and on it is, let us say, a ball. I quickly pull the bench away, and the ball falls to the ground. How would most teachers today explain this to a child? They would say, quote, "The ball is attracted to the earth. If it is unsupported, it is overcome by the force of gravity," unquote. But that does not really explain anything. Saying that the ball is subject to the force of gravity is really meaningless. It is one of those verbal definitions we have already mentioned. Again, physicists say that nothing is known about gravity and its nature, yet they speak of it anyway. But we cannot avoid speaking of gravity. We must mention it. Otherwise, when our students enter life, they may someday be asked to explain gravity, perhaps while being evaluated for a job. Just imagine what would happen if a 15-year-old knew nothing of gravity. There would be a terrible fuss. So we must explain gravity to children. We must not be foolish enough to close our eyes to the demands of the world as it is today. But by working on their subconscious, we can awaken beautiful concepts in the children. Because we have established the groundwork, we can make this clear to them. Quote, "Here you have the intake of an air pump containing no air. If you remove the stopper, air flows in quickly, filling what had been empty. This is related to what happens also in the case of the effects of gravity. When we pull the bench quickly from the ball, something flows in there as well. The only difference is that in one case, outside air flows into an empty space, whereas in the other case, the effect works in only one direction, toward Earth." End quote. Now you compare these two phenomena. Footnote, see Lecture 7, The Foundations of Human Experience. End footnote. Do not give children verbal definitions, but show them the connections between the concepts and the phenomena related to air and those related to solid bodies. Once we have grasped the concept of solid bodies, flowing in the direction in which they tend when not prevented, we can dispense with the concept of air flowing into empty space. Healthier concepts would arise from those that fill the world today, such as Professor Einstein's complicated theory of relativity. I mention this as a passing comment on the present state of our civilization, for I cannot avoid pointing out how many harmful ideas live in our culture, such as the theory of relativity, especially in its most recent variation. These ideas run a ruinous course if the child becomes a research scientist. You have now been introduced to a large part of the basis and method for working out the curriculum. End of Lecture 8.